One of Norman Finkelstein's first books was The Rise and Fall of Palestine, a personal account of the Intifada years. And he describes his trips to the West Bank, beginning in 1988 at the start of the First Intifada. Norman would go back every summer and stay with Palestinian families. And this was the start of a long career and life dedicated to the liberation of Palestinian people and to a disciplined, scholarly, multi-decade examination of Israel's treatment of Palestinians. The story of Norman's family is a harrowing one. His father was a Jewish resistor to the Nazis and survived both the Warsaw Ghetto and the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. His mother also survived the Warsaw Ghetto, and she was put in the Majdanek concentration camp. She also was sent to slave labor sites. Norman grew up in Brooklyn. His father was a factory worker, and his mother stayed home with the kids.
I remember that my biggest desire and dream was that if I ever survive, I will stay tall and tell people the story. I now am strictly a pacifist, and I believe that if you kill, you don't achieve. With the first killing, you already lost.
Norman's life story is told in the documentary American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. His first involvement publicly and politically with the Israel-Palestine issue was the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in June of 1982. Norman started to demonstrate outside of the Israeli consulate just off 42nd Street here in New York City. And from his first protest, Norman didn't shy away from using language that described the situation exactly as he saw it. The sign that he carried read, "This son of survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, Auschwitz, and Majdanek will not be silent. Israeli Nazis stopped the Holocaust in Lebanon."
So now I had both a political commitment and a scholarly commitment. And then obviously I'm Jewish, so I had a personal commitment.
Norman Finkelstein became a serious and principled academic on Palestine and Israel, and he soon gained attention from Noam Chomsky. Norman was working on his doctorate at Princeton University, and for it, he carefully evaluated the claims made in a very popular book at the time by Joan Peters. It was called From Time Immemorial, and it was on the origins of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Norman wrote a long, detailed critique of her work and sent out his findings on that book to about 25 people. Noam Chomsky soon gave him a call and provided a warning.
I answered him. He told me later I was the only person who answered him. And his question was, look, does it look as if this is a good topic, a serious topic to study? And he sent the paper. I said, you know, I read it. It's very solid. It's a very good topic to study. But if you go into it, do it with eyes open. You are not only going to undermine this book and show that it's a fraud, but you're going to undermine the whole U.S. intellectual community.
With each new book he's written, Norman has found himself being chased out of the academy, usually under the guise of budget cuts or other technical issues. After teaching for 9 years at Hunter College in New York, where Norman published The Holocaust Industry in 2001, the school claimed they had a shortage of funds and offered him less courses. That book was a searing indictment of the money made by using the stories of Holocaust victims.
I'm not happy with what happened. I didn't ask for a lot. I was earning $18,000 a year at Hunter. Nothing. And they kicked me out in the street after 9 years.
Eventually, Norman landed at DePaul University in Chicago. But then, during a televised debate hosted by Democracy Now!, Norman accused the famed lawyer and major Israel supporter Alan Dershowitz of plagiarism, and he attacked what Norman viewed as his flimsy evidence to back up his positions on Israel and Palestine.
If we're going to have a civil debate, you're going to have to remain...
But it's not going to be a
you're
debate
going to
about
have
me.
To,
Let
you're
me
going,
be very
I'm
clear about
I'm not debating
that.
You. Okay. I have no interest in you, Mr. Dershowitz. Right. None at all. I'm interested in the scholarship, and I'm interested in the facts, and I'm interested in your book. Now, in 1984, one Joan Peters published a book called From Time Immemorial. The book was universally recognized by serious scholars to be a fraud. Without wanting to toot my own horn, I'm widely recognized as the person who exposed the fraud. I know that book inside out. I read it at least four times, and I went through all 1,854 footnotes. I start to read your book, Mr. Dershowitz. I then came to chapter 1, footnotes 10, footnote 11, footnote 12, footnote 13, footnote 14, footnote 15, footnote 16. All of the quotes are from Joan Peters.
Once again, Norman's academic career came to a halt as he was attacked in the media.
That was Dr. Finkelstein. He's a professor at DePaul University who might get his tenure on Tuesday if the university allows it. But how can people like this be teaching our children in the classroom? Professor,
thanks. There was a battle at DePaul University over Norman's tenure, and it was shut down after a public campaign against him. Norman says that he has not been offered an academic teaching position for more than a decade. All in all, Norman Finkelstein has authored 11 books, including The Holocaust Industry, Beyond Chutzpah, On the Misuse of Antisemitism, and The Abuse of History. Norman's latest book, which was published in January, is called Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. The book is Norman's opus on Gaza. It's a meticulous 440-page study of international law, of Israel's sustained attacks against Gaza and its people. And the book offers what may well be the definitive history of one of the most horrifying and sustained campaigns in modern world history. Not a single major publication has reviewed Norman's new book. You won't see him on cable news. He is, it seems, completely blacklisted. But he joins us now here on Intercepted. Norman, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
First, just your response to what's happening right now on the ground in Palestine.
Well, it was eminently predictable. In fact, it was predicted, the Great March of Return, as it's been called. And even if you looked at the Israeli papers, they were speculating about how many they would kill. And it's still unclear how many at the end of the day will be killed.
When you say that it was entirely predictable, what do you mean?
Well, the Israelis said they were going to kill the people if they attempted to breach the prison gate. The people inside the prison said they're going to try to break out of the prison. It doesn't take rocket science to figure out what's going to happen in that scenario.
When you say prison, what are you referring to?
I don't want to get too pedantic about this, but Confucius once said, "The beginning of all wisdom is to call things by their proper names." Now, that might sound like a fortune cookie entry, but in fact, it's a pretty profound idea. So in the case at hand, if you look at the mainstream publications which echo Israeli propaganda, or if you just look at the Times, they keep referring to a border fence. A border fence as if two sovereign states stand on each side of that fence. But then let's look at the facts. The Hebrew University sociologist Baruch Kimmerling, he was a distinguished sociologist, and he described Gaza as, and now I'm quoting him, the world's largest concentration camp ever. The respected Israeli newspaper Haaretz, they refer to the Gaza ghetto with the obvious resonances for Jews of the Warsaw ghetto. And then if you take the conservative British Prime Minister David Cameron, he referred to Gaza as an open-air prison. So, is it accurate? Is it calling things by the proper names to say that the Palestinians in Gaza are trying to breach a border fence? No. The Palestinians in Gaza are trying to breach a concentration camp fence. They're trying to breach a ghetto fence. They're trying to breach a prison gate. But that's only half the story, because it's not even a prison. Number one, beginning in 2012, the United Nations, they began issuing reports that said, will Gaza be livable in 2020? Then, in 2015, another report was issued by UNCTAD, one of the premier UN agencies. They said Gaza, on its current trajectory, will not be livable in 2020. Then, in 2017, a senior UN official, he said, "It seems like our forecasts have been optimistic, sanguine." He said, "Gaza has crossed the threshold of unlivability a long time ago." We're not talking about poetry. We're not talking about hyperbole. We're talking about the assessment, the verdict, a very conservative but professional and competent UN bureaucrats. Gaza is an unlivable space. 97% of Gaza's water is contaminated. It's unfit for human consumption. Well, what does that mean? Well, let's take the opinion of Sarah Roy, who's the world's leading authority on Gaza's economy. Both of her parents were in Auschwitz concentration camp. So consider her language. She said, "Innocent people, most of them children, because Gaza is overwhelmingly majority children, 51% children, are daily being poisoned." Now, that's a fact. A lot of people don't want to hear it. They get all squeamish. Why are you talking about concentration camps? Why are you talking about poisoning? Well, hey, don't blame the messenger for the bad news. Israel is poisoning 1 million children. Are the people of Gaza trying to breach a border fence? No. The people of Gaza are trying to breach an unlivable space in which the population is daily being poisoned. Those are the facts. But there's something here that's profoundly wrong. And what's profoundly wrong, in my opinion, I like Bernie Sanders, and I worked very hard for Bernie during the campaign.
So Sanders tweeted this on Monday when this was still very, very much in its early stages. Over 50 killed in Gaza today and 2,000 wounded on top of the 41 killed and more than 9,000 wounded over the past weeks. This is a staggering toll. Hamas violence does not justify Israel firing on unarmed protesters. The United States must play an aggressive role in bringing Israel, the Palestinian Authority, Egypt, and the international community together to address Gaza's humanitarian crisis and stop this escalating violence. Your response, Norman?
There was no Hamas violence. I am not a defender of Hamas. I'm not an apologist for Hamas. But I do care about facts. And I do care about truth. The fact of the matter is, for anybody who's in the least bit familiar with the situation, Hamas has given very strict orders. No violence, no guns, no weapons, no provocations. For the past 2 weeks, Hamas has been absorbing one provocation after another by the Israelis because the Israelis are desperate. They are desperate. As they said in that famous WikiLeak, "We don't do Gandhi well," which means they don't know how to cope with nonviolence because it looks bad when they start using their brutal force against nonviolent protesters. So they're praying, they're doing everything to provoke Hamas into resorting to some sort of violence. So then they have their pretext to come in and, as they call it, mow the lawn. But Hamas has resisted the provocations. And there are 10,000 things to criticize them for, and I'll be the first one to do it. But to their eternal credit, they're exercising Herculean restraint in the face of the Israeli systematic, methodical, desperate provocations. It's gotten so preposterous, so ridiculous, that they need a pretext. And now for Bernie to weigh in and talk about Hamas violence. First of all, let's be clear. They have the right to use violence. They have that right under international law. As a general proposition, they have that right. That's the law. A people fighting for self-determination or under alien occupation, they have the right to use violence in order to free themselves. On the other hand, the law is very clear. An occupying power or a power denying people the right to self-determination, they have no right whatsoever to use violence. So as a general principle, the people of Gaza, Hamas, they have the right to use violence, but they're not. And now for Bernie to do that, no, it's unacceptable. That's not calling things by their proper name. That's being opportunist. It's being cowardly. I know Bernie doesn't believe it, but he has to protect his flank, pretend to be even-handed. No, this is not the time to be even-handed. It's not the time to be even-handed. Those people have been suffering for 11 years under that brutal, inhuman, illegal, and immoral blockade. I'll quote now the New York State Judge Mary McGowan Davis. The blockade of Gaza has to be lifted immediately and unconditionally. Now, I want the listeners to hear that word. It's unconditionally. It doesn't say Hamas has to disarm. It doesn't say Hamas has to stop constructing tunnels. That blockade is illegal under international law. It's a flagrant violation under international law. It has to be lifted immediately and unconditionally. It doesn't depend on Egypt. It doesn't depend on the United States. It doesn't depend on the Palestinian Authority, all of whom want to destroy Gaza. No, the law is immediately and unconditionally, that merciless, cruel, brutal blockade of Gaza has to be lifted.
We hear the Raj Shah and others that are speaking on behalf of the Trump administration placing the blame entirely on Hamas, even when confronted with the number of civilians that have been killed.
Well, as I said earlier, we believe Hamas bears the responsibility. Look, this is a propaganda attempt. I mean, this is a gruesome and unfortunate propaganda attempt. I think these
as though Hamas is launching Palestinian civilians at Israel to be killed. How different, though, is that response that the Trump White House is offering versus previous assaults, onslaughts on Gaza when Democrats are in power?
Well, it was the same. I'll just give you two examples of the exemplary figure, namely Barack Obama. Operation Cast Lead. It began December 26, 2008. It ended January 17, 2009, what Amnesty International called the 22 days of death and destruction. And up until that point, it was the most murderous of the Israeli periodic operations against the people of Gaza. Barack Obama had already been elected president in November. Now, Operation Cast Lead ends January 17th. Why does it end January 17th? Because Obama is going to be inaugurated on January 20th. And that stupefying narcissist didn't want any distractions, any diversions from his inauguration. So he passes the word to Israel, stop Operation Cast Lead. That's the only reason. Now turn to Operation Protective Edge, which unfolds during Barack Obama's term of office. Operation Protective Edge began July 7th, 2014. It ends August 26, 2014. The head of the International Committee of the Red Cross is a fellow named Peter Maurer. M-A-U-R-E-R. And if you go to your Google, and you Google Peter Maurer, Afghanistan, he's been there. Syria, Yemen, Central African Republic, Iraq, he's been there. His job description is to bear witness at war zones. In 2014, after Operation Protective Edge, Peter Maurer went to Gaza. He came out of Gaza and he said, I've never seen such massive destruction ever before.
We have seen a lot of children here suffering, a lot of serious injuries, and you can only be shocked and shaken by what you see as a consequence of the war here.
Bear in mind, that is the eighth Israeli murderous operation on Gaza in the last 15 years. Operation Days of Penitence, 2004. Operation Rainbow, 2004. Operation Autumn Clouds, 2006. Operation Hot Winter, 2008. It begins to sound like an Irving Berlin production. Operation Cast Lead, 2008-9. Operation Pillar of Defense, 2012. And then Operation Protective Edge. And now we have to add the new massacre the past few days. What did Barack Obama do? He kept going out and kept saying Israel has the right to defend itself.
I reaffirmed my strong support for Israel's right to defend itself.
We are fully supportive of Israel's right to defend itself from missiles landing on people's homes.
As I've said repeatedly, Israel has a right to defend itself from rocket attacks that terrorize the Israeli people.
Do you know when he finally criticized it? It's an interesting story. Israel was systematically targeting the UN shelters. These were UN schools which had been converted into civilian shelters.
This is 2014 you're talking about.
It bombed one shelter, a second shelter, a third shelter, a fourth shelter, a fifth shelter. And then the pressure begins to build in the UN system. Ban Ki-moon, he finally had to say something. And he condemned the bombing on August 3rd of the U.S. shelter. Now, the United States no longer even had the fig leaf of Ban Ki-moon. So finally, in the afternoon of August 3rd, the United States says,
the shelling of a UN facility that is housing innocent civilians who are fleeing violence is totally unacceptable and totally indefensible.
And lo and behold, the night of August 3rd, Prime Minister Netanyahu announces Israel's withdrawing from Gaza. The only thing you needed to end that operation was one word from the United States. They could have stopped it. And Barack Obama did nothing. Israel had the right to protect itself. Let's just take some basic numbers. 550 Gazan children were killed. You know how many Israeli children were killed? One. 18,000 Palestinian homes were destroyed. You know how many Israeli homes were destroyed? One. 550 to one. 18,000 to one. And the only thing Barack Obama could see was Israel has the right to defend itself. And not one Israeli, not just today, but in the last 6 weeks, not a single Israeli, forget about killed, forget about wounded, not even a scratch. And you invoke Hamas violence, that's way off base. It's unacceptable.
Has there been any significant change from Obama to Trump as regards Gaza?
I would not say as regards Gaza. I would say it is probably true. The United States was putting some restraint on Netanyahu in previous administrations. I can't document it, but I think it's reasonable to assume. You remember, for example, at that famous news conference where Israel demolished Shujaya. That's another story, and it bears repeating. Shujaya is a civilian neighborhood in Gaza. It's among the most densely populated civilian neighborhoods in Gaza, which is among the most densely populated places in the world. There had been a firefight outside Shujaya, and several Israeli soldiers were killed. So Israel went mad. Israel dropped more than 100 one-ton bombs on Shujaya and fired thousands of indiscriminate high-explosive artillery shells into Gaza. And it was at that point, you might recall, in the news conference, because Israel called it a pinpoint operation, which in fact was true. They pinpointed Shujaya, and they proceeded to decimate it. And Kerry was kind of infuriated, and he uttered, I guess his mic was open and he wasn't aware of it. He said,
"It's a hell of a pinpoint operation. It's a hell of a pinpoint operation."
So there had to be some constraints that were at work with this guy, Trump, and that Pence guy. There are no restraints. Netanyahu's saying, "Don't worry, it will be forgotten in 2 days. All that will be remembered is the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem." And he's right.
So this week, Israel's not only celebrating the founding of the State of Israel, but also it's the date of the creation of the Israeli Defense Forces, the combined defense forces. And I want to read a quote to you that I know you're familiar with from a lecturer at the IDF National Defense College, Arnon Soffer. He said this in 2004. "When 2.5 million people lived in a closed-off Gaza, it's going to be a human catastrophe. Those people will become even bigger animals than they are today. With the aid of an insane fundamentalist Islam, the pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So if we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day."
Let's just stop for a moment. Go to my website. It's going to be a little ways down. Mm-hmm. It's going to be Netanyahu's speech before the Jewish nation. Read what he says.
"It's easy to declare the people of Gaza must be exterminated, but it's not an easy task to accomplish. Most of you will know what it's like when 100 bodies lie together, when 500 are there, or when there are 1,000. To have executed this ghastly charge and to have remained decent, it has earned us a glorious page in the annals of history. We have the moral right, we have the duty to our people, to kill this people who would kill us. We have carried out this most difficult task out of love of our people, and we have suffered no defect within us, in our soul or in our character."
Yeah. "We're killing these people who want to kill us. It's a terrible task. We all shoot and cry, but that's what we have to do."
So whose words did I just read there?
If you substitute Gaza for Jews, that was Heinrich Himmler. It's a very famous speech of his where the Nazis, like some others who came later, they derived this kind of sick pleasure in pitying themselves.
The notion that is put forth consistently by Israeli political figures, mm-hmm. or I just mentioned this geographer who's an instructor at the IDF mm-hmm. University, that Israel has a right to kill these people because it's in their defense. And that is sort of how it's framed. If you say anything about Gaza on social media, you get hounded immediately by people saying, "Are you saying Israel doesn't have a right to defend itself?"
It doesn't have the right to defend itself. You have a right to defend the border from attack. You have no right to cage in a people in an unlivable space who are slowly being poisoned. You reclaim your right when you do three things. One, you end the illegal blockade of Gaza. Two, you end the illegal occupation of alien territory. And three, you give the people in Gaza and the West Bank the right to self-determination and statehood. The denial of all of those three rights means you lose any right to quote-unquote defend yourself until and unless you end those three consecutive compounded illegal situations. You don't have a right to self-defense. You lost that right because you do not have the right if you are inflicting a wrong. Yes, Israel has the right to defend itself, but not until and unless it stops tormenting and torturing the people of Palestine and in particular the people of Gaza. Until and unless, they have no right except to pack up and leave.
What is Israel's ultimate end goal in Gaza, particularly with Netanyahu in power? Mm. What is...
Netanyahu is a very narrow politician. He looks for quick victories. If you asked what's the long-term vision, there isn't a long-term vision. You have to understand the whole Zionist movement, its history, and then the state of Israel, they have holding actions. They wait. They wait. If you were to ask me now, what's the holding action? What are they waiting for? Probably they're waiting for a cataclysm of such dimensions that they can carry out another, you know, miraculous clearing of the land. That would be the ideal situation. Until they reach the ideal situation, they'll just wait. You know, people say, how much longer can it last? It's got to... No, it doesn't have to end. For Christ's sake, the occupation has already lasted a half century. They could keep it going. And as for Gaza, they'll just let it vegetate and die.
What is your analysis of Trump, quote-unquote, ripping up the Iran deal?
It's hard to gauge, first of all, whether there's any foresight or farsight involved in what he's doing. Now, I don't believe that Netanyahu wants a war with Iran. However, it is quite possible that they have crossed the Rubicon, and Nasrallah's his speech he gave about a month ago, he's not a fearmonger and he's not a scaremonger. He said, I'm not saying it's probable. I won't even say it's possible. But he said, we might be heading towards a regional war. And if he says it, I think we need to pause and we need to really worry. You know, people like Trump and Netanyahu, they don't look past the next day. Iran is a 5,000-year-old civilization. It's very patient. You could see over the long term how slowly but surely it's building up a pretty impressive what they call resistance front in the Middle East. And so they're patient. And they may patiently wait for the right moment. And then we're going to have a very, it's not a mess. It'll be a nightmare. It'll be a nightmare.
On that uplifting note, I mm-hmm. want to thank you. I know you always mm-hmm. are, you take your work and the work of those around you very seriously, and I appreciate that stance, mm-hmm. and thank you so much for all of your work, Norman.
Thank you.
Norman Finkelstein is the author of Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom.